And what started happening is that if I spend time in the dark room, I spend enough time on a drawing, I could hear music. And I started realizing that that music is not music from out there. It's happening inside of me.
South African artist Msaki is best known as an award-winning singer-songwriter. She's the ultimate collaborator with big names like Diplo, Black Coffee, and Sunil Musician, but also with the independent artists in her collective Alt Black Continua. She produces her own shows, merging installation and performance, and she's an outspoken advocate for fairness and equity within the music industry. Fetch Your Life, from her huge anthem with Prince KB, is the message Msaki lives by and tells us to do the same. I see my dial, jump now.
I see my dial, jump now. Msaki, welcome. We're going to start with a little rapid fire card game called Keep or Toss. Mm-hmm. So on the table, we have a few cards, and on the flip side is a word. If the word deeply resonates with you, you say keep. If not, you say toss. Are you ready?
Yep.
Let's start.
Hustler, do not identify with that word at all.
Toss
it very far. Bye.
I will do so. Oh, that's a nice one. Empath.
Oh, goodness. I mean, middle kid, peacemaker, introvert whisperer. I find the people that are not fitting in the groove or in the vibe very easily. Have had to learn my own boundaries because empaths are always, you know, ready to swallow the whole situation and try. And, you know, obviously my own relationship with the savior complex has had to, you know, reckon with the fact that I know I'm an empath, but it's like, how do I demonstrate self-love while being empathetic? It's a big lesson for me, that one.
It's a big word for you as well.
A big word, yeah.
So we'll unpack that in a bit when we go through all the questions. That's a good one. Wow. What is it about middle children and being an empath?
I don't even know. Because my own middle child is also an empath.
Keep or toss? Risk taker?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think it comes with wanting to make new parts. I wouldn't have said, oh, what if you can describe yourself? Oh, you're a risk taker. But it comes with the territory of wanting to make new things possible. You have to have a machete or else you're not going to get to the thing that needs to be done. So,
adventurer, keep or toss?
Keep. I just like being outside, upside down in a tree doing things.
Non-binary, keep or toss?
Binary. Yeah, definitely keep. I think my idea of non-binary comes from accepting all sides, you know, of myself. So an example is like, if a person is thinking about how I present, they might be thinking about what my sexuality is, for example. And I'm like, no, actually, I'm thinking about what spirit inhabits me the most when I am in a certain mode. Mm. And so if you're looking at me and you're saying, she's a little bit tomboyish, or she might be, you know, lesbians are always coming for me. And I'm like, unfortunately.
Well, you are good looking, sir.
It's always confusing. But I'm like, no, I think for me, it's spiritual. Like I have a relationship with my grandfather's spirit. And I think that comes out in my DNA and the way that I express myself. Wow. Yeah. I'm thinking about the way that I present, also in the way that I've been socialized. My personality made me an adventurer, so I'm outside playing shibobo fence and climbing things. Mm. And the game that socializes you to be a sweet, feminine presenting girl who sits in a circle and feeds her dolls tea, that's not appealing to my personality. I want to be climbing something and I need to be upside down. Mm. So then that socializes you. You present a certain way, but it's got nothing to do with sexuality.
Exactly.
And it's got everything to do with spirit, socialization.
Exactly.
And yeah, makeup.
I like the idea of your grandfather's spirit being with you and how that shows up for you.
And it's also not the only spirit. So if let's say in this mode of my life or in this, if I'm in a performance mode, what kind of spirit shows up the most? Mm. It's definitely a masculine spirit. Mm. If I'm in a nurturing, if I'm in another spirit where I'm holding community, maybe the spirit of, you know, my grandmother shows up more. Mm. Because that's what's needed and that's the guide the gift of that guide is what is making that moment possible. Mm. And the gift of that guide is what is making me sensitive to that need. So the gift of that guide is going to show up.
That's a good run. I mean, look at that. Non-binary, adventurer, empath, risk taker, mystic, connector, underdog.
Wow.
I mean, if somebody presented these words to me and said, would you like to meet this person? I'd be like, based on that, definitely. What would you think? Would you run away if you...
No, this is cool. I like this person.
That's our game, keep or toss.
I love it.
So, tell me the meaning of your name and the significance that's carried for you.
So my name is Asanda, and that means we are growing. Asanda amantombazane is the usual meaning. That's the extension of the sentence that Xhosa families, you know, will have with that name. More girls or whatever it is that they, and it's just like the family's expanding, or I've got more girls in my family now. But my parents, my mother wanted to name me Zandile, but she was very tired in the hospital. And Zandile and Asanda. Zandile is the past tense.
Exactly.
Zandile intombi.
Yeah.
Asanda amantombazane. So there's a intentional mentioning of like an expansion in my name that I always identified with. But I didn't think that my name was that special, because my sister's name is Siolisile, which means you have made us happy. And then Luvuyiso is my younger brother's name, which means... you are happiness.
Wow.
So you embody happiness.
Mm.
So my name felt a bit random when I was younger, and it was a very common Xhosa name. Everybody was called Asanda. I had like a lot of Asandas in my dorm room or in the corridor at varsity. It was just one of those names.
Mm.
Only really started finding connection with it when I was older, because I think I started understanding how my life was showing signs of abundance, and that it was a value I wanted a relationship with. So anything expansive, abundant, growing, I was connected to it somehow. And like intentionally using that language, you know, as the chakra hands would. But Psaki then, you know, ended up being something that came up because apparently when I was young, I really liked people.
Okay.
And Msaki is short for Nomsakazo, which is short for Umsasazi.
Mm.
Well, it's not short for, but it was like like playing around with the idea of Umsasazi. And I used to, and Umsasazi is like a radio presenter or a person who announces, a person who converses, a person who, and obviously radio in those days was mostly talk radio. That's what my parents listened to. And people would walk in and out of my parents' lives because they had interesting friends, they had teachers that had, you know, friends that were living in the Eastern Cape, but they're actually Ghanaian, and they've got these rich stories. And I'd always meet beautiful people in the lounge, and I'd be like, who are you? What are you doing with your life? Like, how do you know my parents? And you know, black children are meant to be seen and not heard. It was like, this one is a Msasa Zilona. She's interviewing people here. And then it was like, you know, that name was this... the way that they used to tease me to kind of mind my own business. But I just got more interested in people, more curious about what they were doing there and who they are and what they're going to do with, you know, with their entire lives.
Wow.
So Msaki is a kind of contraction of all of those names.
Mm.
And then because I was called Msaki at home, the neighborhood called me Msaki. So people that, if I'm in East London, in Amalinda, and I'm walking to the shop, you know, the people in the hood are going to call me Msaki. And that's what they're going to shout if they see me in the streets or ask me for 2 rand or send me somewhere. And so I felt like having that name as a stage name was inviting people to a part of me that's close, but also giving me distance from my real name.
Incredible. Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Giving me a bit of space and anonymity, but not really feeling far from people. Yeah.
And nowadays, do you feel more like Msaki or Asanda or both?
I like Asanda.
You like Asanda?
I really do. I think also Msaki has become I first have to understand when people are using that name, like, do you need something? Do you want me to show up in a certain way? Can I just be, you know? And I can't always answer that with an answer that makes me feel comfortable in the time. Mm. So Asanda feels more... like you're accessing my humanness.
Mm, yeah. Like you see
not,
me.
Not the avatar, not the caricature and the... Yeah, not the avatar that also I sometimes use to protect Asanda.
Mm. And do you think someday Asanda and Msaki will be integrated? Because I know, you know, Beyonce used to have Sasha Fierce. We don't hear about Sasha Fierce anymore because I think she's become Sasha Fierce, but now she's just Beyonce, right?
No, I think there's a dance that happens. You know, sometimes the avatar helps, but other times it gets in the way. And I also think that artists need to learn, you know, it's something that I also sometimes struggle with, like, are you able to separate yourself and put the avatar down quick enough in moments where you just have to be a girl or a mom in a room? And sometimes you don't respond immediately, and that moment needed you to be like, put it aside and be exactly who, you know, Asanda is. Yeah.
But I think also off camera, we've discussed as well how we all show up as various people depending on the situation.
Yeah.
Even without being an artist, I think we do it in our daily lives, right? I mean, who I am as Kanyagile, the daughter, is very different to who I am as Kangi Koza in The Professional, for example.
Sure. Yeah.
So I relate to that a bit. But yeah, I think it's also cool. Looking down at the word connector, that even as a child, Umsaki was, you know, the connector in the family as well.
So maybe. I think so.
Okay. So growing up in your household, I mean, what were some of your family traditions? How were birthdays celebrated? What was valued? And what was punished?
Wow. Dishonesty, punished. We'll never forget the day that I was sent to school with 20 rand to pay for the term photos. And I got to school and I bought my whole class hot dogs. Like, you get a hot dog. Everybody gets a hot dog. I was bawling in the tuck shop, like making it rain.
20 bucks.
20 bucks covered the bill of everybody that was in the line.
What a feeling.
And I'd forgotten that money was for something else. And when I got home, my dad's like, oh, we want to see the photos. And I was like, photos. The 20 rand, I opened my bag and then the wind went. And my dad's a criminal lawyer, used to people lying on the spot all the time, can read body language a year away. He just looked at me and I remember he heard my voice because I was stumbling and stuttering over my words. He was reading the paper and he just lowered his gaze and I saw him. Look at me just over the paper. And obviously he was reading like the cartoon section because he loves laughing. And it's like cartoon section, sports section. Then he goes to the front page. Then he goes to page 3. So I saw him and I was like, he's I'm so busted. He looked at me and he said, you come back when you're ready to tell me the truth. And he just went back to his paper. And I remember the feeling, the lump in my throat that just was not coming down. And I walked to my room and I came back and I apologized and I told him what I did with the money. And I never lied to my dad again. But that's also, you know, my dad was not a person who was going to raise his voice or shout. But yeah, that was something that was just not acceptable in my house.
And that's far more powerful, right? That very steady voice. You'll come back when you're ready to tell me the truth than any other raised voice.
Rather than a slipper that's like being flung down the passage, passing your...
I can feel the stress. I can feel the stress. And what was celebrated?
So my parents also, I think... We, you know, I grew up with these two really gifted siblings. My older sister, amazing achiever, always had trophies and certificates coming home. And my brother also, you know, was like into rowing and sport and rugby. And we used to come home with certificates and we'd get awarded things. And they were just silently, like, I remember not making a big deal out of achievements. And my mom would just take things out of our bags and like put them on the fridge or put them on display. And even our certificates and our medals and my mom's made collages and they just quietly put them up. They don't make a big deal out of them. I don't think it was like an ego building exercise, but it was like, we see you, we're proud, but no big pomp and ceremony. Very, very like quietly acknowledged, you know?
Incredible.
So we did, you know, I just thought it was normal. I thought like every household is just like this, but I realized that they were doing something quite special for us, just saying, we see you, without it being like, we need this, we need to see this for this to be, this is like your identity getting etched. No, it was like, whether you achieve or not, you know, but when you do, we see it and we're behind you, you know.
I have to say, just hearing you speak and some of the conversations we've had, I feel like you carry your family with you. And I just want to also honor your parents, because when you speak, you sound like you've been parented very well. And even in speaking on achievements, you also talk a lot about your siblings and how much they've achieved, right? Which is not always visible to the public eye.
Sure. No, I really, I don't think I was an easy child to parent. And the way that my parents, handled the challenges that I had as a growing soul is something that I use in my parenting journey. Like, the grace, the acceptance, the non-judgment, the just the space, you know, to figure it out and to come to them when you need help. But it was also like there was a firm, you know, one of the things that my dad passed on you need to have a self, an inner dynamo. He used to, during the December holidays, my brother, my sister and I, and we had a cousin that lived down the road who also was playing like provincial netball. And we would be running the whole holiday, 5 a.m. every day to the bridge from Amalinda to Heaven Hills. And not because somebody was whipping, like had an alarm or something that was going off at 5. My dad was quietly up. He stretches. You join him if you want. But he modeled this, like, I'm choosing to start my day this way. And he's like, and he said once, like, imagine how nice your holiday is going to be if you know that in January you're running cross country. You know that you've got a season coming up in Feb. You know that you've got things that your body needs to get ready for. You've got all this time. Imagine how nice your holiday is going to be when you're playing video games or you're going to the beach, but you've done a little bit of something towards that goal. You know? And that was just like a thought he put on the table. And then the rest, we just like, you know, were able to mimic his discipline for his own goals, you know? So it was quite... It's quite a gift to not be forced into a way of thinking, but for it to be demonstrated and for you to take it up because you think, oh, this is what I want for myself as well.
I mean, obviously the podcast is called The African Imaginary and we're interested in how the imaginary is shaped, right? And you talk a lot about your parents. You talk about how you grew up. And it sounds also like you grew up in a family that appreciated music as well.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And I mean, if you think about the imaginarium or the imaginary and how you make your own set of rules for how you want to conduct your inner world. One thing that, you know, from the way that I've been raised is that I'm seeing that kids don't do what you say. You know, it's that saying is famous for a reason. Like, you kind of have to inspire behavior in a way that isn't dictatory. You have to find a way to charge the space with the spirit of the thing. So it's like, hey, we are all using things that we've taught ourselves. Let's demonstrate an atmosphere of curiosity if you want your kids to be self-learners. So it's not about every 5 minutes, you're supposed to be reading this. You're supposed to be curious about that. You're supposed to, it's going to go in the one ear and out the other ear, knowing how I picked up information. So it's like, it's really inspiring to think about how do you charge the atmosphere to have that value rather than talk to the thing and impress the value from another place, trying to get it inside of somebody else, you know? Yeah.
So now we're going to get to that, your journey and how you got here. But, you know, every journey has its conflicts. I'm interested to know, who was your first enemy or what was your first enemy?
What is
and how
this?
Did that relationship shape you?
Wow. Yo, it's a very, very strange relationship. And it also, the cross-section is there by empath as well. Because my first bully, I had so much empathy for my first bully. The scenario is grade one. We are in an underserved school in a town called Pedi, which is also, what is Pedi's name? Engushwa.
Okay.
So 30 minutes away from an hour away from Grahamstown.
Okay.
And 30 minutes away from King Williamstown. Small little town it's a town with like a pep store, a church, a tennis court, and a hotel called Satisfaction. I don't know if you ever watched Cha-Cha.
Those Eastern Cape hotels.
Did you ever watch Cha-Cha? Because Cha-Cha was shot there.
Okay.
And nothing happens there. My parents were teachers in a village close by called Macheledwana, but they lived in town, Epedi.
Okay.
And the only other school besides the one they were teaching at, Macheledwana High School, was a school called Fezeka Primary School. And that was a little bit of a walk away from where we stayed. And my grade one teacher was an alcoholic. She was definitely in an abusive relationship.
Diagnosed alcoholic.
Mondays were not a good day. Mondays, she would come with a black or blue eye. And we just knew that something was off here. And it was the only school that was available. The reason why I bring this up is because my first bully is situated in a dysfunctional space where social ills are high. She's probably repeated grade one 4 times. So she's not the same age as us. She's tall, she's lanky, she's obviously on some kind of spectrum. She only has the fact that she's big and powerful and she can boss people around. Hmm. And she sat next to me. She used to steal my pencils. And at that school, if you didn't have the station, you would get a lash. So she obviously didn't have somebody but to buy her station. So I'd share my stationery. But she first took it from me, you know. And then this story is the one that breaks my mom's heart, because they'd make me lunch every day and it would be a sandwich that they'd cut like in quarters. Yeah. So if you count, they're 8 pieces. And this girl had a group of friends that were her age, but they're in grade 4. So every break, she doesn't even have friends in this class because indangaza are older.
Have moved on, yeah.
And so she was still the ringleader of that group, because in the, you know, in the hood or wherever she stays, in Lokshini, she's still like big and scary and powerful. And she's got like, she has a charisma to her as well. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember her name, but she would steal my lunch or take my lunch from me. But she would invite me to come and join her group of friends. So
as your initiation.
Me, like, drag me to her friends. So I'm like there. They, and she would share my lunch. An eighth of it each with her friends. They would take
wow.
the... So I would get 1/8 of my lunch every day.
Oh, wow.
I kept quiet for a year. My mom discovered this at the end of the year when I'd lost a bit of weight. I was a bit terrified of school. Mm-hmm. And her best friend that was a teacher said, this one is doing well. She's number one in her class, but she doesn't know very much. I've just tested her. Mm. Like there's stuff, there are big gaps in what she's supposed to know at the end of this phase. Mm. So we spent... My mom, they changed and they sent us to St. Andrew's prep, which was a big sacrifice and a stretch for 2 teachers. You know, they're a principal and a deputy in another high school. They're not earning very much, but they were just like, we can't leave. Like, this is no, there's no future here. Mm. And so they sent us there. But I remember the December holiday was a catch up. It was my mom's friend teaching me things that I'd missed. It was a little bit of counseling because they realized I was slightly traumatized.
Oh, wow. Sure.
And it wasn't like counseling as in going to someone, but it was like, tell us what happened. Mm. Who was this girl? Mm. Why didn't you say something? You should have said, we could have packed more food.
Like, oh, shame.
And I was just, you know, I didn't understand that I was being abused. You know,
exactly.
And I think the empathy, also understanding that she didn't have what she needed. Mm-hmm. She is also displaced in this class. There's no remedial education. Mm. Somebody's missed her and is making her humiliated by sending her back to the space where they're not teaching her in a way that's going to serve her needs. Mm. So I think there was something that I don't think I understood all of those things and their complexity, but there
of
was
course.
Like, I befriended her some way, even though she was bullying me. Mm. And that was, so I can't even call her an enemy, because my even when I think of her, my memory isn't bitter. It's sad for her, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's probably, you know, your early experience of a conflict that you had, even if it was internal and not exactly physical.
I'm like, I'll give you the pencil, it's fine.
But. Yeah. And how do you think that shows up for you today? I mean, it might not just be that one experience, but just that sense of having an adversary, and having your lunch taken away.
No, you have to work really hard to be my enemy. There's one guy in the music industry that's like upset my friends. And the reason why I cannot stand him is he's an exec who's made some of my friends doubt their God-given talent.
Wow.
Because you've gone and exploited them so badly that they don't believe that their talent can take them out of that situation. And that breaks my heart. And I can't even be in the same room as him. I saw him at my concert backstage and I was like, security! My
what
most
is he
dramatic
doing here?
Moment. I was like, what is this filth doing in my... I was like, vermin!
Yeah.
And it's the only person that I like outwardly will express my disdain for. And
And does he know this about you?
No, he knows.
Okay.
He keeps his distance now. But then I think he didn't know like how much I knew. And it's unfortunate that the people that he's exploited, you know, they even suffered a Stockholm syndrome for him. So I lost some friends because I was pointing out the truth about this guy.
Yeah.
And they were just like so deep in the toxicity of that relation that they couldn't see it. Yeah. And I lost good friends. And now we're kind of mending, you know, they're also getting out of the situation and it's working out where he's exposed now.
You know, in my experience, I found those people become your prophets. In a sense that people who exploit you often see something in you that is exploitable. And sometimes you haven't even discovered that about yourself, right?
And I find what comes across as Stockholm syndrome is sometimes you processing the trauma that you've experienced under this person. But if you use that and let it serve you, for me, it's been a great catalyst to my life. So I, you know, have had similar people, definitely. Corporate toxicity abounds everywhere. And they've become my greatest teachers in a very bizarre way. And it's a very strange relationship to explain to people. But I literally call them my prophets. Those are the people who saw things in me I didn't realize I even had.
That is fascinating. Because what I will tell you that the gift that person has is that they will spot a rare and special talent from a mile away. And sometimes before the talent spots itself.
Hey. Which is a very difficult
Witchcraft.
Thing to acknowledge.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
That's why I give them the name of a prophet. But fast forward to the present. You're a singer, songwriter. But who first planted the seed? Who nurtured your gift of music and Ooh. Helped you become who you are today?
Oh, man. I missed it for many, many, many years. And I remember a teacher in high school who was saying, hey, what are you doing? You know, when you get out of school, what are you? She was a kind of choir. She was helping the school come up with plays and all that stuff. But it wasn't very, very serious in the school that I was in, that whole cultural activity. It was just like a pastime and a thing to keep the hostel kids busy. Mm-hmm. And she just casually said, you know, if you want to take this music thing seriously, I can help you get a scholarship in UCT, you know. I do remember that being a significant moment in high school where I betrayed my gift. I didn't understand what she was saying.
Mm.
And to me, I was like, oh, I'm just realizing that I really, like, I'm more academic and I want to do something prestigious. I come from a good family that, you know, I don't want to be frolicking in the music department, please, you know.
Mm.
And I think I just had a diminished understanding of what this could look like. And so I brushed it off, but I remember maybe a few, and she entered me in the Stedford, I got a gold for a solo, and I still didn't see it. Like, she was really trying to show me that there's something here.
Hmm.
And then even earlier in primary school, I do remember getting a solo, and I had to sing, zippity-doo-da, zippity-yay, my oh my, what a wonderful day. Plenty of sunshine heading my way. Zippity-doo-da, zippity-yay. And I was in grade four. And the teacher that was taking all of us for singing, there was no special music class. There was like a few, you know, recorded lessons here and there. But she entered me in this, I Stedford as well. And we missed it. We got there the wrong day. I think I was meant to go the day before. We left with the school bus. She took me. I was the only kid singing a solo from my school. And we'd missed the class. And I remember being like, that was weird. What was that? You know?
Yeah.
But she tried to also kind of isolate my voice, you know, in a chorus. And I didn't understand why she was doing that as well, because I didn't think there was anything special about my voice at the time. So I missed it for a very long time. But those were the little human angels that were like on my path trying to say, whoa, just pay attention to this, you know?
Incredible.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't even know when I actually really, really took note of it. I think it just grabbed me by the scruff of the neck at some point when I was, you know, I was immersed in visual art and I was trying to figure out my artistry and my creativity in general.
Mm.
And what started happening is that if I spend time in the dark room, I spent enough time on a drawing, I could hear music. And I started realizing that music is not music from out there. It's happening inside of me.
Mm.
And it was just that deep meditation that, like, working on a drawing for 58 hours gives you that I've just, as a busy ADHD, like running all over the place, very sporty jockey kid, I just didn't have the time to quiet myself long enough to hear that there's constantly music that's like hovering over me.
Mm.
You know, so that was late. That was in university. I was a Rhodes student studying fine art. And then I just was starting bands. Pulling in collaborators, making music with whoever had time.
Mm.
It just started pouring out of me, almost like a floodgate had been opened.
Wow.
I think, yeah.
But I think it's also very confusing when you're a bit of an all-rounder as a kid, right? When you have various talents. I mean, it sounds like you were academically gifted, you had the sporting talent,
And then you had this creeping thing called some musical talent, right?
It was just something in the periphery, and I think because of the way schools would elevate, an athletic talent and elevate academic prowess, you missed the other things if you didn't go to a school that was intentionally, like National School of the Arts, like you, intentionally trying to grow the talent and see it in its nuanced ways. I honestly downplayed it to myself, but I also had this big fear, and it's something that I still reckon with today, that like, oh, you're a jack of all trades, master of nothing. And I used to hear that all the time. It's like everyone's like, you're doing everything, you're doing too much, too much. And the voices of you're too much were somewhere there, like,
yeah,
at the back of my mind, almost telling me that I'm unfocused and I'll never amount to anything, which is what, it's such a lie.
Well, I mean, in the world of multi-hyphenates, right, you are well prepared, that's for sure. And I think it also shows in how you carry out your career. I mean, I think you are multi-talented in various areas, but we're going to get to that in a second. I also want to know, who are your African or diasporic icons, creative or otherwise, and who has influenced your work and how do they live in your music?
So crazy. Wow. Okay, so I'll mention three people. I'll start with a very obvious one. Not because, she was a global superstar that made sense in the States. And I love Miriam Makeba because she was intentionally embracing the continent. It inspired me to learn how to sing in Portuguese, in Swahili, in Lingala, in Arabic, that ambition is there because of somebody who was intentional and saying, I want to understand this language sonically, and I think seeing how she would move and actually just embody even the way that people sang in those spaces, I was very impressed by how she knew how to learn people through music. And there's that. There's also obviously the bravery, the activism, the understanding time and place, and geography. I think she was an amazing role model. I actually think that I don't think we get how iconic she was, identity, understanding, what was required of her also as a storyteller. Like reading her own personal memoir was almost like a spiritual awakening for me when I understood her story and some of the pain and the sacrifice. It's like, I wouldn't want the story, but the fact that she lived it means that we need to, that it's like, there's more required of us. Like, oh, kings, like, what have we done? Like, what else can we do? Because this is quite a legacy to leave. So there's that. There's also somebody that is much quieter, but is a force in the way that I have fallen in love with literature, and we were with Tsitsi the other day. Usi Tsitsi.
Tsitsi Dangaremba.
Yes. And I really love the way that she, the way that she's kind of understood the power of story. I have this thing where if I write a song and I don't feel like it arrests me, like the first line of Tsitsi Dangaremba book, I go back to the drawing board and I'm figuring out like what it is that the song needs or the line needs.
The first sentence of a Tsitsi Dangaremba novel is
that's my challenge. I'm like,
so
if it
powerful.
Doesn't arrest me the same way, then I need to go back and see.
And it's true, you do that.
I mean, try to.
You have like these, to me it feels like a random sentence, right, which just keeps ringing in my ear. I mean, I think I played one of your older songs at the beginning before we started recording. And I just can't get this line out of my head. And it evokes such emotion in me. So I think you do exactly, it has the same impact on me, at least, as that first sentence of a very powerful novel.
Do you know what it makes me feel like? It feels like there's a veil. And then the first line of a Tsitsi Dangaremba book is a very, very sharp knife that just slits it open and you kind of walk into a world. So I want to have that feeling. I want to have the feeling of just having something revealed to me that can possibly be only be open if I shift dimensions, shift vantage points. And I think that's a magical, like it's an alchemic thing that she has. And to have that access as an artist or to have that intention, it's a beautiful goal to have as well, to be like, okay, what does this first line do? If I say to you, you need to imagine where is this place? Mm. Why are people blind? Why can they all of a sudden see? Mm. And it's like the same feeling that you get when she says, I did not cry when my brother died. And I'm like, what is this? Where are we?
I'm going to cry now. Exactly.
How did we get here?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Mad, inspirational and beautiful person as well. Like, just such an honor meeting her. And then my very, very good friend, and possibly, yo, it's also beautiful to see somebody that you look up to up close. It's Neo Mayanga, somebody who's made artistry and also the workflow of art and like the practice of art makes sense to me. So it's one thing to have the output and to be like, oh, he made that opera. Oh, he wrote the music for that ballet. Oh, he is half of that pop duo. Oh, he did that installation. Oh, he wrote that paper. The output is one thing, the byproduct of who he is. To see the practice of somebody who's making things that you believe in and making things that move you, that is a, I feel like a gift from the universe to be able to see that up close. Like one of your favorite people also be a guide, also be a mentor, also be a brother, also be, you know, like a kind of soulmate as well. And somebody who's a mirror who says, oh, yeah, you can be all of these things and more. But do you not know who you are? You're just, you're infinite as well, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how did this happen to me? Like I lucked out.
Yeah. And to watch them and to observe and to learn. And I know what you mean when you say it's one thing to see the outcome, but to see the process unfold.
Yeah.
But what is your creative process? I mean, is it led by heart, head, or your hands? And what enhances this process for you?
I went to, at the beginning of my creative journey, I went to, it was 2012, I went to a school called the 18th Journey in North Carolina. And it's a very strange place because it's not a conventional music school or an art school or a spirit school, but it somehow has all of those things. It's called the 18th Journey. That's the distance between the head and the heart. The head and the heart, 18 inches. And there's something that happened in that time that prepared me for my career. Because there are things that I believed here about what art is, why I'm here, why I create, what that looks like. And then it was like, in that time, the first thing that we were told to do was to pens down, tools down. It was like, okay, you all managed to get here. 300 people applied. We chose 30. You are those 30. We know that you're talented. We don't care. Put down your pens. We don't want to hear you saying we don't care what you can draw or whatever. Different, from different backgrounds, different countries, all different disciplines. And they said, for a month, we're just going to love on you. We're going to speak worth over you. We're going to make sure that you rest, eat well. We're going to feed you with art, feed you with the idea of community by showing you how we live. And nobody wanted you to do anything. It was like, if you come from a place where competition has shaped your excellence, we don't care. Mm. That's going to die in this 3 months that you're here.
Incredible.
If you come from a place where you have to perform your worth, we don't care. You are worthy right now. Before you make a single thing or sing a single note, you already are worthy. If you come from a place where you need to, you know, rely on your creativity to survive, we've got you. We're feeding you. This is, you know, you don't have to do anything to survive.
Yeah, sure.
So there's like so many things that got healed in that month that different people came with. And there's something that shifted. Even the understanding studio practice and understanding your own ebb and flow, some of the principles that I use today I picked up in those couple of months. Like, how do you set yourself up to win as an art practitioner? When do you make? When do you stop? Do you know when to rest? Do you know what season you're in? Are you meant to be hibernating? Are you meant to be outputting? What do you need to do right now to make sure that you are in alignment with how you create? And I didn't know at the time that I was learning those things, but those have become interesting principles that I use today because I've also burnt out when, you know, I burnt out because I wasn't connected to those ideas, you know, in a very logistical way. I kind of knew them here. I mean, so it's like a constant journey back to understanding what that is in the heart. Like, you can know that you need to rest, but you kind of need to do something else when you feel it from here. Then it's like you won't compromise that. You won't compromise a sense of balance. You won't compromise a sense of rest. You won't compromise a sense of connection. You won't compromise a sense of understanding where you fit in your community. No matter what the check is, you're not going. You're not.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. So I didn't even know how to explain what happened to me in that time.
Wow.
But the byproduct is that I do like structure. I do like space for spirit and improvisation. But I will ferociously fight for time to just understand what's going on inside of me so that I can be true in the output.
Wow. So at its deepest level, what would you say is the heart of your creativity?
Let me see. I don't know. I don't know if it's like, yeah, I feel like plants make oxygen and we are creators. And I don't think that it's something that I've ever questioned. Like, I think it's a byproduct of who we are. So I don't know if, you know, if I say what is at the center of my creativity, it's maybe sinking more into an I am energy, like an accepting energy, not a striving energy. So the more I'm just able to relax in who I am, and the healthier I feel, it's like I don't, the more connected I feel, the more I create. So it's, I don't do well in, so an example is I've had to go to so many big Hollywood writing camps, and I'm there with the best writers in the world, and there's 20 of us, and there's a deadline, and we need to write for his album. And I get there, and I'm like, there's an energy in the room that has, we're creating because we've been told that the Billboard Top 40 sounds like this, and then this album needs to sound like this. And the A&R says that this needs to sound like that. And the urgency is that this album needs to be making the record company money. And she needs a hit that sounds a little bit similar to that hit that she made last. Now we're creating from the outside in. Now there's another energy that isn't just sinking into the fact that we breathe creativity when we just, you know,
just are.
And so what happens is that we slip out of that I am energy and we're striving, and then the creative process is corrupted. And yes, maybe there'll be a few hits that come from there, but I will always walk away from that space thinking, what was I doing in that room? You know, there's a feeling there that doesn't feel connected to what it actually feels like to accept that you're a creator. There's something else that I can't explain, you know? So, I don't know. I think now that I'm a bit, I guess I have choices, and I've got, and I understand what I need to set myself up to be creating a way that feels connected to me. I can say no to those rooms now. But I didn't know better because I thought, oh, I want to be a songwriter. This is what you do in Hollywood. You book a million sessions and it feels like speed dating a bunch of strangers, and you're opening your diary up to producers that you've just met, and there's something broken about that.
Wow. But it sounds like you are someone who's very aware of the connection between your head and your heart, and as well as your hands when you create music.
You would think that it would help me make better choices sometimes, but, you know, sometimes you
better music, maybe not better choices, yeah, but, you know, we'll take one.
Sometimes you need to be there to know that you don't need to belong, that you don't belong somewhere. So I've forgiven myself, but it's like, sometimes I have just found myself in the most bizarre places.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an ongoing struggle. So now let's talk about imagination, and specifically the African imaginary. What does this concept mean to you, and how do you understand the idea of the African imaginary in your own words?
Okay. This is a beautiful question. For some reason, I'm seeing shapes, and the shape that comes to mind when I think about how Africans create and make is round, you know, and yeah, the sharp corners where energy gets stuck, they're not there. And it's not to say that, like, there's something about healing in a circle, creating in a circle, understanding collaboration better, which I think is inherently African. And yeah, all of these ideas are coming back as buzzwords that were being sold back to us. But that idea of even, like, when you look at these shapes, the way that we do architecture, the way that we do community, the way that we do family. It's like everybody is facing inward and looking. There's a tribunal, there's a common voice, there's a inherent wisdom that the collective has. And so I believe in, like, I think we just have this access to a collective African library that is so intelligent, that is so communal, that is so acknowledging of, like, how everybody sees this problem or this idea or this moment. Mm. And so I don't know, I can't shake that, you know, the fact that, like, a lot of African things feel like they are expressed in circles.
Yeah, wow.
I don't really know if I'm like what that means, but that's a picture that I have in my mind. Mm. You know, thinking about architecture, thinking about community, thinking about art, you know, thinking about spirit. Like, it all feels very, very circular.
Mm.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, I think you articulated very clearly when you told me the story about being charged $100 for a yoga class in LA, being charged $100 to take your shoes off and to just have a sense of community. And you thought, how are we paying for community?
Let's hold hands and a grounding circle. I'm like, why does it cost me $100 $100 to take off my shoes and hold hands with you guys? Yeah. This is what we do at home.
Yeah. And I think the idea of community and collaboration is, you know, very well articulated by that sentiment as well.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's a big hoax, but yeah.
So let me take you deeper with some specific examples from your journey. So Sauti Sa Busara and Alt Black Continua. Am I saying it?
Yeah, perfect.
Correctly. Where you curated some musicians from across Africa for Sauti Sa Busara, which is obviously a music festival which took place in Zanzibar in February this year, where you created a space that was described by one of the artists as kind, peaceful, and spiritually connected. So what does this collective Alt Black Continua mean to you, and what are your hopes for its future as a collective?
Oh, so Alt Black, you see that again, you see what, if I think that's what my friend Islam said, it's the collective energy that we had in that space when, you know, all the egos are dissolved. What are we trying to do there? We're trying to learn each other's songs. The most humbling experience, trying to learn a new song in someone else's language. You already are starting to see them as it's like, it feels like a distant thing in something you're not used to, and you're already a little bit stressed out. So the humility is there. But the discovery is that, oh, we also have this rhythm. Oh, you guys use that. You guys also have songs of water and songs of, you know, you've got songs about the same thing that we're concerned about. And you start to see that your perspective is the same. You're fighting for the same things that are dying. You want that language to not go away. You want that sense of, you want that vantage point to not go away. And all of us are all trying for the same things, but from different places in the continent. Mm. And we really, really, really connected, because I think in a space where everybody's dissolved, and what we're trying to do is kind of find the collective soul or soul of the song, magical things happen. Mm. And I, you know, with Alt Black, I really believe that these connections and the way that we see each other better as artists will affect programming, because once that connection is there and there's a collaboration and there's a new world that's built because an artist from Uganda really understood an artist from Lesotho, and they want to make music together and they want to spend time together, they want to send energy each other's way. Whose joy of jazz, you know, to say, no, that connection can't happen. And the programming is going to get affected because of an alchemic connection that happened in a room, some hot room in Zanzibar, you know, with no air conditioning. It's like, and you can move and see the world and understand people better because of connections made through art. And if that is not a way to change a space or change a perspective, I don't know what is. Mm. Now, let's say Muhammad from Khartoum and northern region of Sudan, where his tribe is actually, his language and tribe is dying and going away. He's there as a storyteller, understands his people, understands the perspective he's fighting for more than anyone. Mm. Will come to South Africa, inherit our audience that is curious about the space, that usually only hears it from Al Jazeera or some weird Instagram post. Mm-hmm. We'll get to hear from the horse's mouth an artist who's fought for his own energy, he's dragging his community along, he's keeping himself not only alive, but creating, which is a miracle in itself, when you're kind of fighting for basic needs and are wanting to just survive the next day. And you're losing family, you're losing sanity, you're trying to make sense on a logistical level to people that are still alive. But you are now in another country and they're saying, tell us about Sudan, you know. How can you not, then the heart of what's happening gets transferred to a new people, and it does more than what an Al Jazeera, and there's nothing wrong with Al Jazeera, but this is how we're getting knowledge about what's happening in other places in the continent, and it's not always pure, you know. So there's also that where you're really, really getting the heart of what's happening somewhere else, and you may not have known. And this is all through art, this is all through music, and I think the potential of what we can do for each other and the way that we can hold space for each other is massive. And I hope that, you know, I hope that people can start to not feel alone, because also that's the part of Out Black, the logistical part of it is like, just because you're independent, which is a smart thing to do, it doesn't mean that you need to feel isolated. So that's the slogan you had to say. Just because you're independent doesn't mean you're alone. And there are many ways to make people feel like they're held. Yeah.
Incredible. I think you are very good at striking a balance between, you know, ownership and having creative independence. And I think it's amazing that you also drive a sense of community and collaboration when it comes to your music. How have you gotten that subtle balance so correct? And what is it about this, fixation is a strong word, but you're quite serious and firm about having ownership of your music as well?
So that part is so that you can build creative relationships freely. And, you know, on a practical level, as an artist who needs to express and have autonomy over your product, you don't want to be told by the marketing department that that song needs to sound a little bit more upbeat because that genre that you're expressing is 10 years old and now people are listening to Amapiano. You need to be able to say, you know, show them a huge zap sign and say, this is my music, I can do what I want. Just on a creative level, freedom of expression. As a creative who has a unique perspective. But on the spiritual level, I think my love for the music value chain has developed over time because of a fierce custodianship and an understanding that we need to protect the soul of the song from, you know, the idea's inception, which is usually a magical moment that nobody really overthinks. It's like, you know, you're either with your friends and you guys are having a great time and someone's inspired and a song happens, or you're in your room and those moments where you get to slit the veil and see what's happening on the other side, they remain mystical and profound, and it's not something that anybody's owed, you know? But this is the creative process, and this is something that I think needs to be revered. And that moment deserves to also be shared as purely as it arrived. And so the music value chain, or the art value chain, mustn't corrupt it. And it can be corrupted at any of those levels, you know, whether it's, how do we package it? Let's put it in a miniskirt. Does it want a miniskirt? No, it wants a hijab. Then get it a hijab. Then here, how do we narrate the story? Are you using the right PR agency? What are their principles? Is it a male chauvinist PR company that's going to show you in a certain light and think, only DJs should be spoken about this? If you're a vocalist, you're just the hundreds and thousands. Like, you need to be asking questions in every step of the music value chain. Is the soul of the song being served, preserved, revered? Will it get to the end the same way, or will it be an unrecognizable? And that's the thing that happens, you know? Literally, the only reason that I care about the business side of music is because I understand that responsibility. And I do like structure, and I do think that there's a way to create new parts for things that are made that need to express themselves. Because I think the song precedes us, you know, and so it had a life of its own. I'm the one that caught it, and I'm the one that needs to protect it so that it gets to the audience in a way that is intended, you know. And if we can lose the plot even right at the end, now it's like, okay, how do you share it? Do you want to launch your thing at an old biscuit mill because that's what it feels, that's what feels right? Or do you want to go do a silent party, Kwamaimai, because that's what your song needs? Or your business partners or your record label owns a fancy restaurant in Sandton, and that's where you're going to launch it. And you can betray it even at the end. you betray the way that the song wants to show up in the world. And I think it's not as easy as a song just showing up on people's phones. You know, that's like the tip of the iceberg. There's an entire soul, there's an entire life that deserves to, you know, be expressed.
I mean, I love that. I love the idea of being a custodian of your music, you know, from start to finish and never relinquishing it, you know, to time and chance, but sort of having control and overseeing and being intentional about where it finally ends up. Because I think one of the reasons why we're even interested in the African Imaginary is to create a platform for those voices and to create this body of work where we can tell these stories, but in a respectful way as well. I think it's quite tragic when you see how many artists have no control over where their music ends up or how it ended up in those spaces. So I think it's quite remarkable how you've approached this. So I want to talk a little bit about some of your collaborations as well. So you've worked with giants like Black Coffee and Diplo. So when Diplo calls from Los Angeles, what do you take with you from Africa? And how do you define that soulfulness, the speaking from the heart that you carry so well?
So Diplo is an interesting character, very misunderstood. Has a real beautiful love for nuance and different kinds of people. And I, you know, I've become friends with him over the years, as room splitting as he is. One thing, you know, that I've liked in terms of working with him and writing music with him is that not even having to explain, like, our one song that's out is called Sour Sour. And that's just because I really love being in East Africa and I love the sentiment of this word, you know. Sour, like, sour. Sour Sour. Yeah. Pole, pole, sun. Like, it's just these beautiful words that come in twos that just feel like a pat, like, Sour Sour. Everything's going to be fine. It's okay. No problem. Thank you. Or such a beautiful, like, and this is how I feel about African languages. You know, they have they've got 1,000 layers. And they can't be translated and kind of truncated into one flat, you know, gigabyte of information. So I think the first thing is that I like that, you know, the openness to just let that be the message. I don't think that's something that's difficult to fight for when you believe in the richness that we have. Because what I'm realizing is that, especially in the UK, especially in America, even people that are working in spaces where maybe the PR is further along in terms of how they tell certain stories, there's a curiosity about how we express similar things.
Yeah.
So, in the US, I work a lot in folk music, country music. I go to folk festivals, singer-songwriter festivals. They're interested in why, you know, I still present in the same way. Maybe there's a guitar, maybe there's a fiddle, but I'm singing in Xhosa or there's Uadi. They're interested in these deviations and, you know, things that come from our heritage that, you know, is not necessarily something that is freely available for them to dig into or to have as a historical reference point. We're offering a lot of richness and the jig is up. Like, there's nothing about us needing, we don't need the American story more than we need our own story.
Exactly. Yeah. Speaking about discipline, so the other thing that's not, well, I think people know this now about you, that sport is a big part of your life. If they follow you on Instagram, you're quite competitive when it comes to your tennis practice. And I like the fact that you haven't transitioned to paddle. So clearly you're still a purist.
Talk smack about paddle. I'm a smack
with a champion squash playing sister, but we'll let the paddle players off the hook. But you've credited sports with giving you the discipline to back yourself as an independent artist as well. So creativity is often celebrated, but discipline less so. Why do you think so few artists are able to show up with your sense or similar sense of clarity and discipline that you have towards your music?
I mean, I think everyone's trying and everybody's trying to figure out. I mean, you're essentially your own boss, so you have to give yourself your own deadlines, your own parameters. And passion sometimes isn't enough, Kangi. Like, you need to... There are days where I don't feel like writing, but if I open my writing desk and I sit at the chair, I'm never not rewarded with something. And I think because I've seen that play out, I don't wait to be inspired. And I told you the root of my discipline story was modeled to me. And it's really literally like that question of what do you want for yourself? And so the things that I'm doing every day, when they're put together, are they giving me the picture of a person who wants that thing? You know? And if there are gaps, then you know that you're going to have a patchy expression of this thing that you supposedly want. And I think also being privileged enough to be pursuing a career in something that is deeply connected to me, that I'm passionate about, that feels like breathing, you know? I don't take that for granted. Like, I know that people feel like they're betraying the love and the passion and the natural gifts that they have every day because they have to make a living. And so the fact that those two things have aligned for me and somehow there's an abundance in it and I can also make space for other people, grateful every day. So the responsibility is that then I must wake up and I must send that email, or I must write, I must do that thing, I must meet that deadline. I'm writing for a play. I must not let down the team. Let the music department not be the weakest link. The choreographer's on time. I must be there 15 minutes before. And so discipline also comes with respecting the craft and your collaborators. And it's not even about appearing to take yourself seriously. It's because it is serious, you know? It's also believing, I think I'm so convinced about the power of art that, you know, talking about it, I feel like we are harvesting medicine as well. You know, the same way that people are trying to send food into places that are, I would like to be breaking in and sending art, and because there's it's medicine. And I'm more than convinced about that. So I think the urgency is there, and I understand the weight of this thing that we carry. And I also believe that because people are edited out of their creativity so early in their lives, it's almost like if you have a way to demonstrate it and ignite it in people, it's an emergency that it gets done.
I mean, it's a business, right? And I like your sense of urgency around it. But I find it hilarious when you say passion is not enough, because I agree, but it's also a bit of a controversial statement. I'm a big believer that, you know, hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard.
That's true.
And
you see it all the time. I know, have many, many talented friends that are, they're underserving their gift and they're underachieving, not because they want to, but because they haven't learned to back themselves and train their spine to show up before the talent does.
Yeah. You know? I think that the urgency is also driven by the fact that there's such a wealth of talent out there, right, which never really makes it into the forefront. And that's a bit frustrating, no?
Especially in South Africa. And this is why all these countries are here, writing camps, mining us, coming here for photography, exhibitions, taking art straight from here into galleries somewhere else. They understand that there's something special happening here, but the infrastructure and the training and the vision making is lacking.
Yeah.
And the production quality. So there's tons of raw material. It's like the saddest African story. We're being mined on all levels because we don't know how to do that for ourselves. And so, one, you know, it's like you were saying about your, what did you call them? Your prophets. You know, there are prophets on boats arriving from across the seas every day saying, yo, magic. Let's have a camp. Let's harvest it. Let's make sure we lock them into a contract. Let's make sure that we are getting beats, you know, sent to us every, before somebody figures out how to make a healthy structure around this. Which is why I'm like, building structure is just as important as in knowing that there's talent. How does it get harnessed in a way that's ethical, in a way that builds the talent, in a way that gives back to the community? Because if we're not going to do it, there are boats that are arriving that are going to do it very fast, and they don't care, you know, what they leave behind.
And how do we build that structure? I'm very interested in, you know, how we capacitate the industries to set up the right infrastructure and the structure. I mean, we talk a lot about funding, but I don't think people even know where that funding is supposed to go. What are the gaps you believe we have as far as the infrastructure is concerned?
I don't firstly think that there's a lack of strategic thinking on the continent. I just think you take away people's basic needs, you bomb them, you make the family unit have to, you know, disperse to survive. You know, every country has got its own story, whether it's urbanization, whether it's, you know, a male labor force being in another province, whether it's the minimum wage not making sense to actually keep. There's so many things like that are political, that are economical that are making it difficult for the strategic thinking to even have space to grow. It feels like a luxury to have that.
Mm.
And that's why maybe, you know, it looks like there's strategy and there's infrastructure in other places. It's not because the thinking is not possible here. It's just that the time to build that has, it's not a basic need, you know.
Okay.
And so this is my thought. It's not that we don't have producers. It's not that we don't have vision-making people. We don't have strategizers. Where are they going to get trained if we are still trying to piece together the family unit?
So training is an issue, right?
We don't definitely have... that, I think. But I don't think that we lack the thinking. But now it's like, how do we harness the thinking and how do we get it doing the structure making?
Yeah.
And I don't have the answer. I don't have the answers. But I do think that people need to point and say, for instance, you know, if I go to an arts community or an arts center, the kids are going to aspire to what they see. So what's visible? A DJ. You know,
okay.
Less visible, a ballerina. Less visible, an A&R strategist for a music direction for a company. Whereas, like, in Hollywood, you're going to meet one of those at a coffee shop. You're going to see them at an open mic. There's an A&R guy sitting there watching a person perform for the first time. You don't have to be seen doing well very long in a space like East Hollywood.
Hmm.
You are going to get picked up. You're going to have an agent. You're going to have a strategist. You're going to have a book, a manager. In 3 to 5 business days, if you have an amazing performance,
yeah.
Because they're ready, there's an overflow of those kind of thinkers and they're visible. And that means that people can also aspire to say, like, I want to be an A&R like Jeff Davies.
Yeah.
Because they're visible. They have a story. There's a title. There's a job description.
Hmm.
And, you know,
yeah.
Because the industry... Is alive and well.
Yeah, there's an ecosystem as well.
There's an ecosystem for it, and it's been there because of, you know, I don't know, Warner Brothers or whatever it is that started. You know, so it's such an interesting thing that, like, the visibility will create the desire and also the next generation.
Mm.
And if they're not even seeing a songwriter, they're not even seeing a female producer, they're not seeing a black record exec or a black... You know, I don't even know. Like, it's difficult to
aspire.
Put it in the imagination of young people to even want to be that thing. It's not going to happen, you know.
So do we not have the visibility because they're simply scarce, those...
Yes, there's that.
Those professions, the A&R people, the big producers, the singer-songwriters. Is the lack of visibility just driven by the fact that there's just not that many of them who operate at a very high level? So it would be difficult for a young person aspiring to enter into the music business to say, I don't want to sing, but maybe I want to work in A&R, for example.
Yeah, definitely.
Wow.
Definitely.
Wow. That's interesting. I mean, you know, I'm always fascinated by the value chain and the ecosystem in an industry. And I think that's something that you touch on, but I definitely think, yeah, maybe in the future in South Africa, for example, that even how we imagine art schools, how we imagine even, you know, high schools will be slightly different by introducing, you know, these various careers. I think at the moment it's still very one-dimensional from my assessment.
Yep. Yeah.
So let's talk about relationships. You've often navigated your artistry alongside reflections on gender and relationships. How has that journey shaped your music and your sense of self?
Yeah, very, very honestly, always processing, you know, I think relationships are a mirror to me, so we can learn more about ourselves. I don't know what this whole life experiment thing is about, and I wish to... you know, maybe in the last week of my life, say, yeah, you know, this is what I have some kind of reflection, you know, retrospectively, because I've understood something over time, but it may stay a mystery to the end. But I do know that relationships are a way to understand your soul family, understand, like, where you are in relation with your own journey to love and understand yourself. And maybe that's all it is. So I find that music for me is a way to kind of measure those gaps. You know, if let's say I'm in a relationship and I'm the one that's always going to the halfway mark, and then I go past the halfway mark, what's making that extra journey, and why is this person not walking towards the middle? And these songs are searching for those, like, you know, it's like a ruler trying to measure the 15 meters or and I think one of the things I'm learning about the question that keeps coming up is always like, have you learned to love yourself yet? Have you learned to love yourself yet? Okay, prove it in this situation. What do you do? How does it manifest itself in this situation? And so my songwriting is always a snapshot of where I am with that question. Have you learned to love yourself yet? And sometimes I look at the song and I'm like, yo, it was bad. Like, I was setting myself on fire to make this room warm, and this room needed to be the Arctic, because that person needed to go buy their own jacket. What the heck?
And
the song is there as an evidence in the timeline that I had no clue that I needed to choose myself in that situation. Wow. And that's literally what my discography is, a picture and almost like a map and a diagram of answering that question at each time. It's not about, did you love that person? And I was like, did you learn to love yourself in that situation?
You know? Okay.
I have a song called Dreams. I wrote it in varsity. It was one of my first heartbreak songs. And it was a heartbreak because I had basically had all this love to give to a person who, on their timeline, had a container. Like, I had like maybe this much love to give, and this person's container was this big to contain love. And I was constantly saying, no, but here's the love, you know? And I remember this line in the song. It says, wish I could show you more love and store it in your heart. It's guitar. Wish I'd inspired you to fight for our place in the ark. So it was this like sense of something is about to get destroyed and everybody's walking off in pairs. And we're not going to make it into the ark. Like, yeah. I know that I can't inspire that desire in you, you know?
Wow.
And I think I was like 20 or something. And I, you know, lost my favorite soccer jersey to this dude who tried to show up as if he could hold the love that I had. But actually, just in his timeline,
he's cuffed him.
He's cuffed him. I was like, it's me. It's not his fault.
And not even a tap away.
And I should have been like, hey, I've got a big scuffed here. Let me walk away. But the answer to the question was that, like, I hadn't learned to love myself enough to even recognize that these containers is a mismatch, you know?
Wow. I mean, so, and have you learned to love yourself?
I think I'm learning, Kangi. And the decisions that you have to make to demonstrate that you love yourself are heartbreaking. It's another kind of heartbreak, because you walk away from people that you love. You walk away from situations that you prayed for. But it's like, it's showing up in a way that if I engage in this in the way that it is set up, I'm proving to myself that I don't love myself enough yet.
Yeah.
And so it's becoming more and more gray. Like, it's not black and white. The more I get asked that question, the grayer the answer is. And it's like, oh, I know this situation, but this person has done the work. They're more self-aware. But they're not self-aware enough for me to prove that I love myself in the situation. So you have to leave it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a far richer question is, did you learn to love yourself in that situation? Because I think to ask it as a general statement is a little bit difficult. But as we close, let's look toward the horizon. You know, death is a difficult but profound question. What is your spiritual path or practice, and where do you imagine you will be laid to rest one day?
Yo, what is this question? I don't have one spiritual practice. I really love the idea of creating rituals for my own sense of self-compassion. Okay. It's actually something I use a lot in my art. Rituals for self-compassion are a way for me to embrace my shadow. And I think for me, my spiritual path is an intentional integration. I really like becoming less afraid of embracing the imposter. I don't like things that are painful. I don't like confrontational conversations. I'm learning how to make those a priority as a sign that I care for the connection or the space or the moment. Because on the other side of conflict, there's always some kind of intimacy where you've learned something that you wouldn't have learned if you didn't run away. if you Absolutely. Ran away from the moment.
Absolutely.
And I used to be a runner. So, man, like turning and facing things that are not comfortable is like a spiritual practice, whether it's in my own room at 4 a.m., whether it's sending an email that I didn't want to send, or whether it's having a tough conversation with my mom about a wound she doesn't even know anything about. Mm. It's like, I want to leave having addressed things. I want to leave with at least what I do see, the shadow that has come up. I want to be able to say, okay, little friend, like, let's come sit over here and let's just bask in the sunlight together. And it's not really, you know what I believe, Kangi? I don't believe that we are searching to become more light.
Mm.
I don't believe that anybody is missing any light. I feel like we're luminous beings already.
Yeah.
The only thing is the opacity is about the filter, the one full of all the lies, the core lies, the you're not enough, the... you know, the hurt, the blind spots. There's like a filter, and its opacity has got to do with how much we accept our shadow and our darkness and our pain and our scars.
Mm.
And that starts to be a bit lighter. And so the luminosity that's already here starts to, has like...
Raise almost.
It starts to actually be able to, you know, shine through that opaque filter.
Mm.
So we're dealing, and this is why I think a lot of the work is here in the dark.
Mm.
And a lot of the work is unpleasant. And a lot of the work is answering questions that are not hard, not easy.
Mm.
And that demonstration of how much you're learning to love yourself is, it actually, the work and the byproduct of it is that opacity lifting. So we just keep choosing situations that give us opportunities to clean that filter, to clean that filter, to clean that filter.
Mm.
And so I don't know. I don't know where I'm going to end up, but hopefully I'll be a light being, as in like more luminous because I'm dealing with that filter more bravely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also just like a light, you know, not a heavy person.
Mm.
I don't want to hold any grudges. I don't want to, and that's the journey. So I'm having those conversations. I'm having those release conversations with myself. I'm forgiving myself. I'm forgiving people. And it's not, and I'm a coward, so it's hard.
Mm.
Like I'm really, really not built for painful things, you know? And it's also that middle kid empath who's like, I want to keep the peace. I want to make sure it's all smooth. But it's like, you can't live like that. Like things are going to hurt and you have to move through them.
Yeah. I think that's so profound. I mean, I think about death, almost daily, and not in the grim sense, but it's linked to legacy, right? And the infinite world. And, you know, when you talk about just being this light being, I often think about, you know, what is the legacy that you want to leave behind and how you conduct yourself on a daily basis is sort of me defining how the type of legacy I would like to leave behind. So it's an interesting thing to interact with on a daily basis because I think it also drives the sense of urgency one has about how they live and the type of life that they want to live. But I don't agree with your assessment that you're a coward, though. I think you engage with very difficult topics in a very gracious way, which is part of why your music is so soothing, even though the topics can be quite difficult as well.
Thank you. I'm getting braver. I know that, but I know my nature and understand how this thing has shifted over time.
Mm.
You know, but like I'm not made for those tough conversations.
Yeah.
You know? But I'm growing that muscle now, I think.
Well, seeing that you also are transitioning in your career, you are as young as you are, you're pretty much an elder because of your body of work and experience. So I can imagine a lot of young people come to you. So what are some of your dreams, goals and aspirations for yourself, as well as the communities you serve and the artists that you work with?
On a very practical level, I would love for the end of my career to mean that I've done enough work to make songwriting a viable, profession in South Africa, on this continent, in Nairobi. And there's specific places where I think I can affect it in my lifetime.
Mm.
And that's an infrastructure building exercise. It's a bridge building exercise, which I love.
Mm.
And I think, you know, it's more writing camps, it's more knowing each other, it's more capacitating each other as songwriters and song catchers.
Mm.
And it is both a spiritual and logistical exercise. I have a hard hat on, and but I'm also like, you know, I don't even know. Have a sari on under. I don't even know how to. The picture I have in my head, but it's like it's a dual job, which I think I'm made for.
Mm.
For myself, I really want to. I have a lot of ambition as a storyteller. I think, I'd love to win a Grammy for writing a song one day. I don't even think it's The Hill. I think it's still a credible, like some of the people that I look up to the most, like a lot of my favorite songwriters, they have been rewarded in that way. And it's not about the Grammy. It's about like being validated as a storyteller that matters or made a song that connects with that generation's sentiment.
Mm.
So there is a kind of thing I feel about the times, and it's like, am I going to be able to make myself a vessel to express some of the things that are going on in this time that I find myself existing in? So, you know, I have an ambition to write, when I say big songs, it's like songs that come from a place in the heart or a place in story or history that are marking a moment.
Mm.
So there's did the song do something in the time to hold on to a thing that was needed or that was missing or that was echoing something that was happening or lamenting about something that was going on?
Mm.
And if it was not able to be done in any other time, like it needs to be true to that time.
Okay.
And the reason that I was there in that moment, experiencing those emotions with my community.
Mm.
Because I feel like that's the thing about artists. We feel the tremor. It's like we're in the middle of the earthquake and we are at the epicenter of that first tremor.
Mm.
And part of my purpose is to say ouch when it hurts at the right time.
Mm.
Or to say, oh, the tsunami's coming, you know, or to say that government is like, it's about what is happening. And we as the artists, the empaths, the feelers, the people that get the shake first, it makes you look mad sometimes because you will feel it first and then the ripple effect is happening. But I think that communities are not going to be alive if the artists are not feeling and their skin is not porous and they're not feeling those tremors and those shocks first.
Yeah.
Which is why they deal with artists first.
Yeah.
You know? It's what's killing the nerve receptors in a community. So I think my thing is if I stay supple-hearted and I stay connected and I stay connected to how I feel and I can change and I can feel the changes like in the breeze, I'm still staying very, very sensitive outside.
Mm.
It does mean that I'm doing my job. It doesn't matter how it looks. I just need to stay supple-hearted.
So finally, what conversations do you believe African creatives need to be having with each other right now to shape the future that we want to create for the creative industry?
Much more intentionally multidisciplinary conversations. I think, I'm a romantic also because I like, I'm a hopeful romantic. That's what I call myself. It's also because I like the era. I like the time, you know, where artists and musicians and painters and sculptors and everybody was just like sharing space as well and kind of cross-pollinating ideas from their different mediums.
Mm.
And I think we need more time like that. I'm falling in love with theater because you can't make a play alone.
Mm.
And you need to be inspired and completely in awe of your choreographer and the person that wrote the script and the way that the director is holding the space and the soundscaper and the music director or the composer. Like, everybody sees what they're bringing to the thing and believes in the how massive and exponentially huge the collective is. Like, it's not one plus one. It's not like there's six of you, so the power, you know, the power of this collaboration is six. It's like you realize that, no, the power of this collaboration is 60.
Mm, mm.
And there's, you know, when you buy into that, it's a very beautiful thing to know how you can affect, how you can blow a message up or a moment up in a way that you wouldn't have been able to do alone.
Mm.
So more collaboration, more cross-pollination across genre and medium ways of making and thinking. Mm. And I think also more sharing of success stories in each other's respective spaces.
Mm.
just to know, and also maybe failures, but I don't know. Like on the continent, we are mysteries to each other still, which is a tragedy.
Wow.
And so we just need to travel to each other more, see each other's perspectives better, understand each other's stories from, you know, where they're told. And there's something there for us, I think, as an African collective or an African imaginarium.
Yeah. I also think education is a big part of your focus on how we create these, you know, these artists, these future artists. Because I know you homeschool your three kids, and I think cultivating their imaginary world is a big part of what you do for them as well.
Yeah, I mean, also kudos to their dad, completely aligned with just, you know, how we believe young people take in information. And it's a real trust in it's like a non-ageist approach to education. Also understanding that kids really need demonstration and facilitation, put interesting things in their path, you know, put interesting things for them to explore. Don't underestimate what they can do when they're left alone with, you know, and don't be scared of letting them be bored. So I don't know. I think for me, we can grow. It's more like they arrive like this. They arrive complete artists that are fearless. And part of the parenting journey is to protect that artist. And some of it means avoiding certain spaces that make them, you know, a clone, or treat them like they have the same way of seeing and engaging the world as all 40 kids in the same class.
Mm.
And sometimes that's not easy to do, and I get how that's a privilege. But at the same time, it's like there are choices that we can make every day that are encouraging the agency as creatives and showing them that they are, you know, are capable of, you know, I think kids are incredible. I don't know how to explain like the things that I've seen, you know, when kids are left alone and are given full trust in their abilities. I think just being able to see that enough is you know, will kind of build a case for you and to understand what it is that they need. They're showing us who they are as soon as they arrive. And so it's like, then you just put more things in their path that will help them express who they are, because they're communicating that. And I think for me, that communication as a mother precedes their arrival on earth. It's like, I trusted that conversation when they were still in my womb. I trusted that conversation in terms of how they arrived, you know, and all the decisions that I've made since then are about a deep trust in that conversation and in that expression, you know.
Amazing. I have to say, it sounds like you're building the African imaginary right at home. But thank you, Msaki, for sharing your journey of heart, spirit, and imagination. This conversation is not only about music, but about the deeper rhythms that shape how we live, how we create and dream as Africans in the world. So thank you for spending your day with us. And we look forward to your contribution to this body of work called African Imaginary. Thank you.